Our brother Ian's overall topic this weekend is Absalom, the Stealer of Hearts. This is Class 2, which is titled The Heart of the King, the Exiled Son Returns. Brother Ian.
Thanks, Brother Josh. Welcome back, brothers and sisters and young people. Why didn't David deal with Amnon? It's probably one of the great questions that arises from this account. As we said, perhaps David saw something of his own life in the boy. He probably saw, maybe reflected, that God was so good to David for the sin that he did, that maybe he felt he should extend that mercy himself to Amnon. Well, forgiveness is a great principle, we know. But the problem with the case of Amnon was repentance was missing, wasn't it? Amnon was not repentant. And the fact that David did nothing really seems to make this situation a lot worse. And so the inability for David to act after Amnon's grievous sin now sets in motion events that are going to shake the very foundation of the kingdom. And that's what we're really going to be looking at in this second session. So we've titled this second session, brothers and sisters, friends and young people, The Heart of the King, the Exiled Son Returns. Because we're going to see in this section that despite all the wickedness and the treachery that Absalom does, David is still drawn to that boy. And although Absalom has David's heart, he wants something more. Absalom wants the nation's heart. And how he goes about that, we'd like to consider. And I would like to suggest, brothers and sisters, for your consideration that Absalom only really starts to embark on how to steal the nation's heart away from David because his plan A did not work. He's a very shrewd politician, as we know. As we said, Absalom watched, and he's waiting for his opportunity to take the kingdom. Well, let's pick up the record in 2 Samuel 13 and verse 22. 2 Samuel 13, verse 22. And I'll read from Rotherham's here. And we read 2 Samuel 13, 22. And Absalom spake not with Amnon, either bad or good, though Absalom hated Amnon, because he had forced his sister. So Absalom demonstrates great patience as he waits 2 full years for his revenge. And brothers and sisters, I think in this beginning of this section we're going to look at, we're going to see Absalom's plan A. And I would suggest that it's even more devious than just the death of his brother Amnon. Verse 23 says, And it came to pass that after 2 full years that Absalom had sheep shearers in Baal Hatzar, which is beside Ephraim. And Absalom invited all the king's sons. So Absalom begins by beseeching David to let all the king's sons join in what appears to be some sort of a banquet that they would hold at the shearing of sheep. It must have been a big festival that they would organize for the shearing of sheep. And he wants all David's sons to join him on his farm in Baal Hatzor. And we see in verse 24, And Absalom came to David, the king, and said, Behold now, thy servant hath sheep shearers. Let the king, I beseech thee, and all his servants, go with thy servant. In verse 25, and the king said to Absalom, no, my son, let us not all go, lest we be chargeable, or that's the idea of burdensome, unto thee. And he pressed him, howbeit he, David, would not go, but blessed him. Well, David seems to be reluctant for the boys to go there. Do you think maybe David suspected something's not quite right? Why would Absalom want all the sons there? And then Absalom specifically asks for Amnon in verse 26. Let my brother Amnon go. Well, David must have really wondered about that request, but perhaps David thought, well, he did call him his brother. Maybe Absalom is not so bitter over what happened anymore. Maybe his hatred is less. But notice from the record, brothers and sisters, there's something more. Absalom invited David to attend as well. Now, take a look again at verses 24 and 25. And look at the emphasis. Let the king. Let us not all. We, myself, David, be chargeable to thee. He, David, would not go. Is it possible that Absalom's plan A was that with one fell swoop, he would not only get rid of the son, the next in line to the throne, but that his real reason was he was going to get rid of David, the king, at the same time? Well, David does not want to attend this celebration. Maybe David remembered another sheep shearing festival, a banquet that was held by a fool that went really badly wrong. Well, Absalom really works on David. In 2 Samuel 13, verse 25 and 27, we read the words, he pressed him. And it's an interesting word. Back in Genesis 19 and verse 3, where it says, Lot urges the angels to seek shelter in his house. Remember that when the angels came into Sodom and Lot urges them to come into his house? He uses the Hebrew word patsar, P-A-T-S-A-R. It means to press or push. Jesenius says it means to beat or make blunt. In other words, that's what Lot did with the angels to get them into his house to save them. But in verse 27, that's not our Hebrew word here. The Hebrew word here is the word parats, P-A-R-A-T-S, and it means to break down. Jesenius says it means to break. In other words, he really worked on David to get David to come or to get David to release the boys so they could all come down for the big festival in Baal Hatzar. But David sticks with his decision. He decides he's not going to attend. But ultimately, David is no match for the persuasion of this favored son, because David at last gives in and lets at least the boys go to the banquet. So they all get to go. So at least part of Absalom's plan is able to go forward. So in verse 28 we read, now Absalom had commanded his servants, saying, mark you now when Amnon's heart is merry with wine. Now remember, where have you heard that idea before? Remember David? David actually did that. He tried that with Uriah. Remember that? He tried to get Uriah merry or drunk as well. And when I say unto you, smite Amnon, then kill him. Fear not. Have not I commanded you? Be courageous and be valiant. Well, Absalom is the type of leader. He's not going to get his hands dirty. He's got a great suggestion for his servants. They can do his dirty work. Verse 29. And the servants of Absalom did unto Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose, and every man gat him up upon his mule and fled. So he has them kill Amnon. So one obstacle to the throne is now removed. The firstborn, the heir, is now killed. And David's sons, what happens? Well, they're in panic mode. Look what just happened. It's unbelievable. And so they make their way quickly back to Jerusalem. And while they're on their way back to Jerusalem, news goes before them. News like this travels fast. They sometimes say bad news travels fast. This travels like lightning. And the problem is, like many rumors, parts are sometimes wrong. And so the news that reaches David is that Absalom has slain all the king's sons. Can you imagine that news hitting David? You can imagine David would be distraught at that news. But there's one individual that steps forward, and he's got more information than anyone else. And he steps forward, and he seems to know what really happened. And when you know it, it's Amnon's good friend, Jonadab, the snake. He's the subtle snake. And he says, "Don't worry, David. They're not all dead. Only Amnon. Don't you feel better?" Well, how would Jonadab know this? Here's a man that plays both sides of the field. He's so subtle that he doesn't even call Amnon David's son, so as not to evoke even more emotion on David's part. He just says, "Amnon only is dead." Verse 32, "And Jonadab, the son of Shimei, David's brother, answered and said, 'Let not my lord suppose they have slain all the young men, the king's sons, for Amnon only is dead. For by the appointment in the margin, it says the mouth, or Rotherham uses the word bidding of Absalom, this has been determined from the day that he forced his sister Tamar,'" which was whose idea in the first place? It was the snake's idea. It was Jonadab's idea in the first place. That was the advice he gave to Amnon to begin with. What a piece of work this fellow is. In verse 33, "Now therefore, let not my lord the king take this thing to his heart, to think that all the king's sons are dead, for Amnon only is dead." So, fearing the worst for the murder of his brother, what does Absalom do after this banquet? After Amnon is killed, Absalom gets on his mule and he flees. And where is he going to run to? Well, we know exactly where he's going to run to. He's going to run to a great-grandfather. He's going to run to his grandfather, King Talmai's house in Geshur. And so that's where he goes. And what started as an evil act by Amnon toward his sister Tamar, coupled with the inability to take action or punishment on the part of King David, now manifests itself in the murder of Amnon by Absalom. And like Amnon before him, Absalom has now taken up the sword, and Absalom's got the sword in his hand, and he plunges it into the heart of David's family, and Absalom flees. Notice in verse 34, verse 37, and verse 38, it's recorded three times that Absalom fled. And you know what's remarkable about that, brothers and sisters, young people? There's nobody even chasing him. There's nobody chasing him. And three times the record wants us to see he fled. And there's a wonderful proverb that catches this sentiment about people fleeing for no reason. In Proverbs 28 and verse 1, it says, "The wicked flee when no man pursueth, but the righteous are bold as a lion." In fact, we know from the record that actually David longed for his son. He's not going to see Absalom again, when we put the record together, for 5 years. So Absalom finds refuge with his grandfather in the land of Geshur. Absalom finds a place, no doubt, with kindred spirits who would love to see the overthrow of the kingdom of David. And I would suggest now, this is when Plan B begins to formulate. Absalom spends 3 years in self-imposed exile. Well, let's take a look and summarize a little bit of what we learned about this character, his characteristics of this man, Absalom. We see his character really starting to emerge in 2 Samuel chapter 13. Because the first time, as we said, we're introduced to him, he appears almost indifferent with the incident with his sister Tamar. The first time he ever speaks, he demonstrates a lack of feelings for others. He shows no sensitivity for Tamar's feelings after the way she was treated by her brother Amnon. And he shows no thought about David's feelings towards Amnon. He's going to kill his brother, and it doesn't matter how his father or Hinnom feel. He's got no regard for the feelings of others. He comes across as very indifferent. We also learn that he's deceptive. He's a cunning man. He never reveals his true intentions. We're going to see that as the record unfolds. He keeps them close to the vest in case anybody catches on to what he's doing. He's a man that has hidden agendas. He's an opportunist. He's actually very patient in a negative way, because he waits for the right time to move, to set the trap, to kill his brother. He's driven by hatred and vengeance. He's also a manipulator. He uses other people to accomplish his purposes. He convinced his servants that they were being brave and valiant to go ahead and kill Amnon when I give you the signal. And they were willing to do it at his command. He even convinces his father David to allow the king's sons to attend the sheep shearing festival. He's a manipulator. He's very persuasive. He's also very determined, because Absalom has been planning the death of Amnon for over 2 years. And nothing was going to get in the way of that being accomplished. But in the end, actually, brothers, we find he's a coward. Because having got others to do the dirty work, Absalom flees. He gets on his mule and he flees to Geshur. And yet David loved this boy. Verse 39 of 2 Samuel 13. I'll read from Rotherham's. And the spirit of the king pined to go after Absalom, for he had consoled himself over Amnon and that he was dead. He pined for the boy. Well, someone else notices that David is heartbroken over not being able to reconcile with his son Absalom. That David even seems helpless to know how to go about doing that. And perhaps, as we say, David realized that maybe reconciliation with Absalom was wrong. Absalom had not even shown any remorse. Absalom should, by law, have been put to death for the premeditated murder of his brother. Nothing had changed. Despite Absalom being in self-imposed exile, nothing has changed. And yet David's heart pines for the boy. And so we read in 2 Samuel 14 and verse 1, "Now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was toward Absalom." Now we know from the record that David had a real friend with Jonathan, didn't he? Jonathan was his really close friend. And God took Jonathan out of the picture. And it was almost like he was left with Joab. And Joab couldn't be more opposite in many ways to David. But it's Joab that recognizes that David doesn't seem to know how to go about reconciling with his son in imposed exile. So it's Joab who takes the initiative. He perceives that the heart of the king was toward Absalom. And so Joab, David's sister's son, the mighty general of Israel's army, wants David focused. He could see David's not focused. And it's important to him that David does get focused. Because there's lots of things to be done in the kingdom. The shoring up of their defenses, the organizing of the economy, and the general workings of the kingdom. And Joab, as we know, is quite a man. He had a couple of priorities in life, Joab did. He wanted the best for the kingdom. We probably today would call him a nationalist. The nation came first for Joab. After that came the throne, and then maybe tied for third was God and Joab. He held the throne in great esteem. The throne had to endure in the line of Judah. Well, Joab senses David's mind is elsewhere, and that's not good. That's not good for Israel. That's certainly not good for the throne. And so Joab is worried about succession to the throne. What happens if David dies? There may be a contested fight for the throne. We're told in 2 Samuel 14 that it's actually Joab who wants his neighbor Absalom back because their farms were actually adjoining. Joab's farm and Absalom's farm joined. And so Joab, seeing himself in the role of a mediator, concocts an elaborate scheme for a well-choreographed play. And as we're reading through that chapter, brothers and sisters, have you ever seen that play before that Joab concocts? Has it ever replayed in your mind before where you've seen that play somewhere else? Because what he's going to do, he's going to enlist a lead actor. And the actor that he's going to do in this play, in order to try to get David to bring Absalom back to the land, he's going to get a wise woman from Tekoa. So who better than a wise woman from the tribe of Judah to get David to reconcile with his son? She's to come before David with an elaborate story. And through the telling of this story, Joab hopes David will recognize that it's really a story about David himself and his relationship with Absalom. That's what he wants to see from the story. And if the plan works, then perhaps he can get David to allow Absalom to come back from exile to Jerusalem. And it's an important play. And the stakes are very high, because Joab needs to get Absalom out of banishment and his crime pardoned. And that's no tall order. He's got to get all of those things done. So this play has got to be very, very good. And to play the part, Joab has a woman dress up, and she's to appear as a widow before King David. And she is to present the case that she has two sons who have had a falling out. And she's to tell David that her boys fought together in the field. And the one hit his brother, and he died as a result of the blow. And she has to be very good at her part of the play, because she has to get David to see himself in the character. She's going to describe, and he's going to then make a judgment, and she's going to have to lock David in to the judgment or the decision that David's going to make from when he hears this play. And it's a brilliant plan. And you think about it, brothers and sisters and friends and young people, we sometimes have a very hard time looking at ourselves, don't we? We are very bad at judging ourselves. We're not very good at assessing ourselves. And sometimes we see ourselves better through the examples of others. That's why the Lord talked in parables and told stories that people could try to mull over and think about. And then later on realize, oh, that's really about me. And so sometimes it works that way. And Joab is going to do that with David in this story, in this play. Perhaps this play is going to accomplish the same result. In fact, the woman is such a wonderful actress, and the script so convincing, that we're actually going to see that David thinks the story is real. So Joab then instructs her to tell David in 2 Samuel 14 and verse 7, he says, "And behold, the whole family is risen against thine handmaid," she says. "And they said, deliver him that smote his brother, that we may kill him for the life of his brother whom he slew, and we will destroy the heir also." And so shall they quench my coal which is left, and shall not leave to my husband neither name or remainder upon the earth. Oh, she's very good. She's a very good actress. She's laying out the story. And did you notice what she did? The first thing she did is she's slowly changing the circumstances. Even though he was worthy of death, this boy, or at the very least he should have fled to a city of refuge for killing the other boy in the field, she wants to see this son in a different light. He's her only heir. Wow. Those words would have a lot of meaning to a king. But I think here too we see the thinking of Joab. I think that Joab viewed as Absalom as the logical heir to the throne. The next thing we see is her story also further changes the narrative. Set the her boy is the only heir she has. Well, in David's case, that's not accurate. He's got all kinds of heirs. He's got all kinds of boys that can take over the throne. And the third thing she does is she changes the motive. For her son, it's not premeditated. The story she tells wasn't a premeditated thing he did. It was not out of hatred. It just happened suddenly. They're in the field and he hits them. It might have been in self-defense. Of course, none of that is directly related to Absalom himself, to what Absalom really did. He premeditated. He thought about it. He killed Amnon. And then she does another thing. She changes the location. Her boy was killed in a field. Absalom killed his brother in a banquet attended by all kinds of people. There's all kinds of witnesses. Well, David ponders the case. And he wants time to consider it. And that's actually a very interesting point, brothers and sisters, that whenever we get challenged with a situation where people want us to make a quick decision, it's sometimes very wise for us to just go away and think about it for a little bit. Try not to be rushed into a decision. I know a brother, for example, whenever I ask him for advice on something, I know whenever I ask, I'll never hear back from him for 3 days. It just goes silent for 3 days. And then I'll hear. Because he's thinking about it. He's pondering. And I think it's a wonderful thing. David wants to ponder the case that's put before him. But that's not what Joab wants. It's not going exactly as Joab or the woman wants it to go. And so in verse 8, David says, I will give charge concerning thee. Well, the woman doesn't want to give David time to think about it. She pushes for his decision. And David gives her a promise that no one will hurt her. Well, she's not there yet, is she? She needs David to make a decision about her son, not her. Verse 9, David says again to her, if anyone tries to do her harm, they will answer to David, and he shall not touch thee anymore. Well, she's still not there yet. She pushes the case again. Verse 11, then said she, I pray thee, let the king remember the Lord thy God, that thou wouldst not suffer the revengers of blood to destroy any more, lest they destroy my son. And he said, as the Lord liveth, there shall not one hair of thy son fall to the earth. So David thinks it's a true story she's telling. But at last, the woman now hears the words that this elaborate play, this elaborate ruse was designed to elicit from David. Your son will not be put to death. And David has invoked God's name. It's clear in other versions. For example, I don't know if you have the RSV, anybody has the RSV, when you read this verse, it says this, then she said, pray, let the king invoke the Lord your God, that the avenger of blood slay no more, and my son be not destroyed. So she's trying to get David to use God's name to lock David in. And so verse 12, then said the woman, let thy handmaid, I pray thee, speak one word unto the king, my lord the king. And he said, say on. And so now she takes the mask off. Now she's going to reveal what the play is all about. In verse 13, and the woman said, "Wherefore then hast thou thought such a thing against the people of God? For the king doth speak this thing as one which is faulty, in that the king doth not fetch home again his banished, your only heir." David, this is what you've done to Absalom. You have banished your heir. And I think her words probably reflected what the nation felt. They were being harmed by Absalom not being home. Verse 14 in the net says, "Certainly we must die and are like water spilled on the ground that cannot be gathered up again. But God does not take away life. Instead, he devises ways for the banished to be restored." Absalom is not dead. God would bring him back. How come you're not doing this, David? Never mind the fact that Absalom should have died for what he did. Never mind the fact that Absalom has shown no remorse. Bring him back, David. Well, now David figures it out. David now correctly deduces that Joab is really the play's director. And so David, he doesn't seem to be upset that Joab or the woman did this. In fact, he really does not show any surprise or upset at how the events worked out at all, or the decision that he was tricked into making. Because verse 21 says this, "And the king said unto Joab, Behold now, I've done this thing. Bring the young man Absalom again." So the play worked. The play was a success. The son who always had the king's heart can now return from exile. Joab's request was accomplished. Now, brothers and sisters, the question we had at the beginning is, where have you seen this play before? Because Joab got this idea from somewhere else. The scene that Joab and the woman set is held on the same field, the same stage. It's the word, Hebrew word, sadah, S-A-D-E-H. And we've seen that field, that stage before, and that's back in Genesis chapter 4. Because brothers and sisters, they used the story of Cain and Abel to get Absalom back to Jerusalem. You have two sons, two brothers, striving together in a field. One boy is killed by the other. A single heir is left. And the widow's son, like Cain, fears for his life. The revenger of blood will seek his life. So we have two sons, two brothers striving in a field. Joab and the woman create the story, two sons, two brothers striving in a field. Genesis 4 verse 8, Abel is slain, leaving a single heir. The woman wants to make the case that one son is slain, leaving a single heir. Cain fears, because of what he did, that he will be himself killed. The widow fears that her son, her heir, will be killed. Cain laments he will be driven from the face of the earth. And the widow fears, no, she'll have no name upon the face of the earth. And that's exactly what it says in the marginal reference. If you have a marginal reference there, it uses the word the face of the earth. Cain pleads for deliverance from vengeance. The widow pleads her son be delivered from revengers. God judges Cain will not be slain. And David judges her son will not die. Now, there are a few twists in the plot. However, God's judgment on Cain was righteous, wasn't it, brothers and sisters? He cursed him. He banished him. and he became a fugitive and a vagabond. But in God's mercy, he placed a mark on Cain so that no man would take vengeance on him. And perhaps David saw through this story. If he did, he would also have remembered how Eve, looking for the promised seed, got it wrong, thinking Cain was from the Lord, that he was the one. And David would need to learn that Absalom was not the chosen one. It's going to be the chosen seed is going to come from Solomon. I think too, brothers and sisters, if David saw the parallels, he would have also seen the differences as well. And unlike what Joab and the woman were painting, Absalom had pre-planned the murder of his brother Amnon. For under the law, it should have been death. Exodus 21 verse 14 in the ESV. But if a man willfully attacks another to kill him by cunning, you shall take him from the altar that he may die. This is different than the case they advance of a heated argument in a field. That would be dealt with by the slayer fleeing to a city of refuge. And so we read in Numbers 35, but if he thrust him suddenly without enmity or have cast upon him anything without laying of weight or with any stone wherewith a man may die, seeing him not and cast it upon him that he die and was not his enemy, neither sought his harm, then the congregation shall judge between the slayer and the revenger of blood according to these judgments. This was not the case of a brother suddenly getting angry in the field, in the heat of an argument, and slaying his brother. No, Absalom deserved to be banished. God had banished Cain and left him to wander in the earth. There was no remorse in that boy. And I think it does appear that David saw this for what it was. Notice what Cain says back in Genesis 4, verse 14. He said, behold, this is Cain's words, thou hast driven me out this day from the face of the earth. And if that's not bad enough, God, what you've done to me, and from thy face shall I be hid, says Cain. From your face, I'll be hid. Now look at what David says to Joab. Go bring back Absalom from Geshur, 2 Samuel 14, verse 24, but let him not see my face. So Absalom returned to his own house and saw not the king's face. And that's going to last for two more years. I think, brothers and sisters, David saw through this. I think he saw this for what it was. And so the son returns. In 2 Samuel 14 and verse 25 and 26, we read this, when Absalom comes back. But in all Israel, there was none to be so much praised as Absalom for his beauty. From the sole of his foot, even to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. And when he polled his head, for it was at every year's end that he polled it, because the hair was heavy on him, therefore he polled it or cut it, he weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels after the king's weight. No wonder the nation loved him. They were in awe of his appearance. He had no blemish in him. He's the most handsome man in all of Israel, even more than David. Even his hair was incredible. It weighed roughly 3 pounds, if we go by this weight, 3 pounds. And the net said, it says he cut it once a year, and it would have been the talk of the town. How much does it weigh this year? How much does Absalom's hair weigh this year? Have you seen Absalom? What a man. In 2 Samuel 14 and 27, we are told about Absalom's children. He has 3 boys and 1 girl, and he names the girl after his sister Tamar. And wouldn't you know it, she was a fair countenance. And in the NIV we read, she was a very attractive woman. So this man, Absalom, everything associated with him was beautiful. the best, no blemish. And Tamar will grow up and marry, get this, she's going to marry Uriel. And they're going to have a daughter who they actually name Maacah, after her grandmother. So Tamar's daughter Maacah grows up to become King Rehoboam's third wife, thus making Tamar the grandmother of Rehoboam and Maacah's son Abijah, King Abijah of Judah, in 2 Chronicles 13, verse 2. Now, we're not sure what happens to Absalom's boys, but we know that they die because when he dies, he leaves no heir to the throne, 2 Samuel 18, verse 18. So they somehow pass off the scene. Yet the spirit of rebellion that he starts is going to continue. And it's no coincidence his granddaughter, Maacah, married King Rehoboam. And by the way, that was his favorite wife, we're told in 2 Chronicles 11, verse 21. And it was that king who was responsible for the splitting of the nation. So it just goes on. But Absalom's got a mission. But even his patience has got limits. And so we read in 2 Samuel 14, verses 28 and verse 29. So Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem and saw not the king's face. Therefore Absalom sent for Joab to have sent him to the king, but he would not come to him. And when he sent again the second time, he would not come. Joab was happy to have Absalom come back, as more than likely, Absalom is now, as we said, David's oldest son and seemingly the logical heir to the throne. This throne would stay safe in the line of David, but Joab seems also okay to keep Absalom at arm's length. It's good that he's home. I just don't want him too close to me. David was probably in a bit better state than he was in before. His boy's back. His son is back in Israel. The business of the kingdom is moving ahead. Now here we're going to see a clash of two very determined individuals, Joab and Absalom. And who's going to win? Well, Joab is so secure in his role as David's chief of defense that he can ignore the heir apparent's request to have him summon. Absalom says, come, I want you to come see me. Come here. And Joab just ignores him. But he's never met a man like Absalom before. Absalom's very secure too. He knows he's got a privileged position. He knows he's got the heart of his father. When he calls, you come. And it's the only way, brothers and sisters, to even consider how Absalom would have the utter nerve, the bold recklessness to have his servants burn Joab's field. That's exactly what he does. You're not going to come? I'll burn your field. Then you'll come. And he does that. Now, does that sound like a repentant man to you? Absalom's back in the land. Joab doesn't listen to him to come visit him. He tells the servants, go. He's always telling the servants to do things, by the way. Go burn the field. That's what they did. And he actually breaks another law. And because he would actually have to replace all of Joab's burnt crop. And there's no mention was ever made. That's Exodus 22 and verse 6. Says if you burn a man's field or destroy the field, you got to replace that crop. So he broke another law. But then he says, now Joab, do I have your attention? Get me an audience with the king. Otherwise, I might have well as stayed in the land of Geshur. And have you ever been so frustrated, brothers and sisters, that you caught yourself saying something similar to what Absalom said in verse 32? It had been good for me to be there still. Or perhaps you've heard someone say in the truth something similar when they're very spiritually low. I had better friends before I came into the truth. My friends in the world would never treat me like that. I was better off before I learned the truth. I might as well remain that way. Well, such was the state of Absalom's lack of spiritual thinking. More incredible still is the absolute confidence he has in his own innocence. 2 Samuel 14, verse 32. Now therefore, let me see the king's face, and if there be any iniquity in me, let him kill me. This is Absalom speaking. He's got all kinds of iniquity. But he's saying, if there's anything within me, let him kill me. This is the way that he viewed himself. Absolutely incredible. So what happens? Joab meditates yet again, and he asks David to meet with an unrepentant Absalom. So he provides the mediator role, he brings the two together, and Joab and David are going to work on reconciling Absalom. And we're going to see how disastrous this reconciliation turns out to be for the kingdom. And so verse 33 of 2 Samuel 14 we read, so Joab came to the king and told him, and when he had called for Absalom, he came to the king, bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. Typically in scriptures, although not always exclusively, the act of humility is shown by the person doing the kissing. Well, not here. David kisses Absalom. There's no humility. There's nothing humble or remorseful about this fellow. Well, what can we take away, brothers and sisters, from this second session? Well, I think the first thing we might suggest is that contemplated reflection on the Word of God and its principles can prevent a rush to judgment. Absalom pressed David for a decision. He was unrelenting until David gave in and let all the sons go to the banquet. The widow woman tried to rush David into making a major judgment, preventing him the time that he needed to make the right decision, even though he initially asked for time. And we've seen the results of both those decisions. So in our own lives, brothers and sisters, we need to contemplatively reflect on the Word of God before we make a decision. Secondly, to avoid being fooled by outward appearances, we need to observe what a person does on a consistent basis. The Lord himself says, by their fruits ye shall know them. David and Israel were fooled by the unblemished appearance of a perfect man. The external presence of Absalom, perfect from head to foot. And we're so susceptible to this, brothers and sisters. We are often fooled by outward appearances. In our children, in ourselves, brothers and sisters, those at work, those that we encounter in our everyday circumstances in our lives. We need to really be careful to observe what someone does on a consistent basis. Thirdly, the demonstration of knowing God's principles is through their proper application, applied at the right time and in the right way. And that's when we know we understand God's principles, when we apply them at the right time and in the right way and in the right circumstances. Absalom's self-confidence and lack of remorse was deserving of exile. David not applying God's principles of judgment to a rebellious boy gave ground to the rebellion that would soon follow. And in our lives, brothers and sisters, we need to be students of the Word. We need to be intimately familiar with God's principles. And we need to know when and how to apply those principles, even in times when the circumstances happen to those that are closest to us. Absalom may have had the king's heart. He may even have won Job over. But what he really wants and what he really needs is the nation's heart. And how he goes about achieving that will be our consideration for our next class.